Good afternoon, and welcome to Loved with Kim Sage on KX at One Laguna in beautiful but a little bit gray Laguna Beach today. I am your host, Kim Sage, and I am a therapist in Newport Beach and currently completing my doctorate in clinical psychology. Loved with Kim Sage is a show about love and relationships, which we will explore through guest interviews, caller writing questions, and often through analyzing the relationship between films and our unconscious mind. As I am working on completing my doctoral dissertation on the use of films in therapy, I just love to explore the psychological content and the sort of process we can get out of watching films and how that plays out in our own lives. So today I'm going to start by briefly discussing the film Big Eyes, which was just is actually still in theaters, and then I have an awesome, wonderful guest joining me. So given the recent buzz around the film Big Eyes, which its female lead Amy Adams actually just won a Golden Globe, combined with our local focus on artists and artistry, I thought it would just be great to talk today about relationships and the relationship between art and love. In the film, it turns out that Margaret Keane, who's actually the artist in the movie Big Eyes, she actually previewed her work here in Laguna back in 2000 at the Laguna Art Museum. So it's kind of an interesting topic for me to come up and then to find out she'd actually been here. In the film Big Eyes, which is based upon real events, Amy Adams plays the painter Margaret Keane, and she's the woman responsible for those really trendy big-eyed paintings of children and animals that really emerged back in the 1950s and early 1960s and became a sort of like Warhol-like pop art phenomenon. The film takes us on her journey that really sort of allows her to let her second husband end up taking credit for her work as a painter, as his deception leads them into this sort of grand financial success and fame. Margaret Keane has to really face herself, in addition to her charmingly creepy husband's manipulation of her, and really the complicit agreement in the scam that she allows to occur. Christoph Waltz plays Walter, the husband, and he's just this sort of creepy and insane and delightful character, which I guess was a pretty close fit to the real life Walter Keane. What seems to really set the course of deception into action is really a letter that Margaret receives shortly after she's arrived in San Francisco. She has just fled from her first marriage, obviously kind of an overnight throw your stuff in the car, not a good scene scenario. And she's got her young daughter in the back seat. And as she arrives to San Francisco, she's really lacking any real skill set to support herself or her daughter, really just beyond her painting. That's all she really has. And so a letter arrives as she gets there, and she's just meeting Christoph Waltz, playing Walter. And the letter basically suggests, now remember, we're back in the 60s, so the letter suggests that because she is a single mother, somehow she's an unfit mother. And so he's threatening to take her daughter away from her. And that sort of compels Margaret, at least in the film, to rapidly and out of the blue accept a marriage proposal from Walter, who she really has just met and doesn't really know a lot about. So the combination of the time in history during the 60s and Margaret's own fears and her new husband's incredibly impressive manipulative talents really set her on this course of self-destruction, as she has to she finds herself, I think, selling her artistic soul and her real world soul in search of stability. So really, while there are a number of amazing factors that play in the film, for me, what I find so fascinating are the paintings themselves. They really speak volumes about Margaret and how she felt about herself and in the world, and certainly how she felt about her childhood. We really get an opportunity through the paintings to view her sense of self. If you've ever seen the paintings, they are these children and animals with these just gigantic, haunting eyes. They're really sad and lonely looking. And it kind of feels like the eyes are a reflection back into sort of a cold world that they're looking back into. And we know that Margaret has talked about this came from a childhood isolation that she had. She had a surgery which left her deaf for a while when she was a child. And she shared in interviews that time period really left her feeling that the eyes really were the windows to the soul, because she had to watch people to sort of read them and know what was going on. And it's just really clear from the paintings that her soul was really sad when you look at the work. So I want to look at the paintings and you really start to see, okay, I can kind of understand why a person who looks at the world this way has found herself alone, and why she might have allowed Walter to manipulate her, and why she stayed in the lie for almost 10 years before it came out that all of the paintings had been painted by her and he had actually painted none of them and didn't even know how to paint. So I wondered a lot about what is her self-esteem like? What was the brokenness for her on the inside that's a reflection in the art? And while we could talk about the film for a whole hour, I really want to talk about the relationship between art and our souls and our journey in life. So given that, I believe art comes from the soul, the creative soul, and it seemed that Margaret's life was her art and art was her life. I just found this wonderful, awesome guest that I thought could come join us and just talk about those concepts. So my guest today is a local Laguna Beach resident, an artist herself, who also believes that life is art and art is medicine for the soul. So please welcome Carrie Woodburn to the show.
Hi, Kim. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited you're here.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me. Yeah. So we're just going to kind of go through. I'd like to first have our guests learn a little bit about you and what you do. Can you describe in your own words exactly what role art plays in your life and in the work that you do?
Yeah, it's I'm new to artistry, actually. I think a lot of my creativity was going into the corporate world for many years. And as you're speaking about Margaret and her story, I'm fascinated by the concept of the eyes. And I really understand it because when I first started painting, it actually emerged out of trauma. It emerged out of heartbreak and a great deal of grief. And with a prayer for somewhere to put this grief where it could be of service versus what felt like self-annihilation. I discovered literally one morning, it was like a spiritual awakening. I awoke to one of those classic bluebird Laguna Beach days, and I thought I heard a voice whispering to me to paint. And I sat up and I took notice, and I went and I bought canvases and paints and I started painting. And I could feel the energy of that grief and broken heart that was so stagnant and stuck moving. And it felt really liberating. And so I really dove in and felt like there was something here that felt like healing to me. And I took one class, an online course, with a wonderful woman in Northern California. That was interesting because it was nothing about technique. It was all about feeling my way through, which was speaking to me at the time. And I'll never forget my son, who was seven at the time. He looked at me one day with my canvas in the living room, taking up all the space in the house. And he said, "Mom, I think you're an artist."
Wow.
And I realized that I was. And so that was 4 years ago. Maybe five now, and I've been on a journey of discovery, and that creative impulse is what I have found to be, like you said, the window to the soul, and it's something we all have and we express in different ways. And for me, to discover painting as an outlet became a liberation and an incredible healing of the heart for myself and my family.
That's amazing. Yeah. And so later in life, this was the first time you had never taken a class and you just started painting. And it really did become a medicine, it sounds like, for your soul.
It was.
Is that how you developed your experience into sort of the work that you do with other people?
Yes, absolutely. And I just want to touch on the eye thing, because when you were talking about the big eyes, first of all, I think we had one of those in the hallway of my home growing up in the late 60s. I do remember it very well. And the paintings that I paint are mostly goddess faces, and the faces are all a representation of myself, of course, and my expression of who I am and who I believe all of us are as universal. All of them up until this last year had eyes closed. It's only been the last two paintings that have had their eyes open. So I'm fascinated with the connection with that. And to get back to your question, I do believe that this process has been so inspirational for me and has moved me in unrecognizable ways through life into a much more happy life and sustainable life and fluid. Things like judgment and shame and all those things that we deal with are non-existent for me, and I really do attribute it to painting. And so I asked Spirit, what is the best way that I can serve with this? Because it felt like such a gift that I was given. How can I serve and honor this in return? And it became clear that the best way for anything is to serve, is to share, and to be generous with what we learn in our own experiences. So I began offering classes, and again, nothing about technique. I find it amusing because I'm at the Sawdust Art Festival, and I'll have people come around sometimes and talk about the structure of the piece and the composition, and I really don't even know what they're talking about. And so I don't teach from that perspective, but I teach from the feeling of the heart, connecting with the heart and letting the hand as an extension of the heart move onto the canvas with that fluidity of the heart and what the heart has to teach us. Because sometimes we listen too much to the mind and we don't listen to the heart.
Definitely. Yeah, you mentioned the topic of shame. So this is something that comes up for me, obviously, in practice a lot. Talk to me about how you would work that into an integration of an actual experience with a group, or what does that look like?
Well, I think it comes up, especially in the context of painting or any sort of creativity, when one is expressing themselves creatively, it's a deeply intimate experience. And so that intimacy, for it to be witnessed by others, creates either an expansion or a contraction. And my experience has been that the contraction mechanism is almost always rooted in some form of shame or judgment. And so it naturally emerges. I don't usually have a topic around that, but it always emerges as a significant part of the process and what there is to heal and grow through.
Right.
Being seen.
Definitely.
Without apology.
Yeah. Well, and you say that because I do art therapy at times with my patients, and I've found that for some people, the idea of doing art, you can see the panic on their faces, right?
Terrifying.
It's like,
yes.
So much. And I think, what is the judgment? You know, they're so afraid. I'm like, you don't have to show because we'll do it in groups.
Yeah.
You don't have to show the group your art. But you want to see sheer panic on people that don't, you know, access their creativity, and it's overwhelming for them.
Right. And then I'm sure you experience as well the freedom that comes on the other side of that when they actually risk being seen. And then we find that, oh, I wasn't annihilated after all.
Yeah, I survived it. Yeah, I'm always amazed at the emotional process that art triggers. You know, you get out of that left brain and you just start really tapping into things, and people will be in tears within two questions. It's amazing. How do you use that in your work? What do you do to help them tap into that sort of unconscious process?
Well, in my work, I work a lot with meditation. And so we open the space with meditation and a prayer, just an invitation for Spirit to hold us in the sanctity of a sacred space and allow for whatever is ready to move. And it's a powerful activation. It seems to just take on the intelligence of the person's soul in relation to their spirit, and what needs to happen doesn't have a lot to do with me. And I experience similarly a lot of emotion and tears and movement. And oftentimes what someone ends up painting is an image of a time in their life that they hadn't thought about in years, where there is some trauma in the body. And so the body memory of that trauma is ready to heal, and it shows up on the canvas without any thought or preconceived planning.
Okay. You mentioned meditation, so that's sort of what that opens it for you. That's how you start.
Yes.
Do you teach meditation? Because people are always asking me, you know, I can't do the thing where I focus on nothing for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And so I usually start with guided imagery, which I think you'd also do.
Yep.
I think it's a great window to sort of, it takes the pressure off. Can you talk a little bit about sort of your process for meditation and guided imagery and what you do?
I'm one of those people who can't sit still. I have often dreamt of going to some silent Zen retreat somewhere for 10 days, and then I panic thinking there's, I don't know if I could do that. So I'm one of those people, and I discovered for myself that what works for me is focusing on the breath. And so what I do is I guide people, I begin with the breath in a rhythmic yogic breath. It's an ancient pranayama breathing technique. And so we work with the breath. So it's something that the mind has to focus on because the mind really wants something to do. Mm-hmm. So we give the mind a process to work with. And in that process, what happens is the breath actually activates the energy centers in the body, or the chakras, you could say. It gets things in the energy body opened up and moving, mm-hmm. so that we're more aware of our energy's body connection with energy in general. And everything exists in energy. I'm very scientific, actually. You know, it's not woo-woo spirit. Mm-hmm. A lot of people might think that, but my interest in this is really from a scientific perspective, because I'm fascinated in how we are in relationship to all things with energy. And so as the mind is occupied, the body and the emotional body, the physical body, and the spirit body have something else to explore. And what naturally occurs is a reach for expansion. And so that's where it gets really interesting. And that's where guided imagery may show up as part of that. If something is present and I feel compelled to guide through a particular process, I'll bring that in. Oftentimes, the intelligence of the individual's higher self, you could say, really does take the lead, mm-hmm. through that process of giving the mind something to occupy with.
Yeah, it's interesting you said the sort of woo-woo things. I think people are on the cusp of really beginning to embrace meditation and all of these mindfulness activities and how they can really be powerful in changing our lives.
Yeah.
Do you experience that with people having a sort of, I want to say, judgment in some way around that process?
I've been working with people in this way for about 10 years now. Mm-hmm. And so 10 years ago, yeah, I think it was a perception that was widespread. You know, the times that we're in now, Time Magazine, you know, the publications, everyday publications are talking about the bridge between spirit and science. And so I think that it's become just a well-known fact that meditation is now embraced as a healthy necessity for a healthy life. And I'm really happy to see that Western medicine in large numbers is leaning towards meditation as a true therapeutic use.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what in your life sets you up to be open to this type of work or experiences?
Well, it's interesting having teenage boys.
Yes.
Because I would have to say it goes back to my early teenage years. I think my spirit has always been connected to nature first and foremost. My earliest memories as a child, long hair, ripped up dress, barefoot, dirty, running like wild, mm-hmm. just wild little girl. And I think I still have that spirit in me, but that was the seeker in me that always wanted to explore and understand more about life and nature. And I thankfully never lost that spirit. But I reference it to my children now because I do remember in the teenage years, my first experience of something that was not going to church every Sunday with my family was reading Carlos Castaneda. Mm-hmm. And I devoured those books from the age of 12 to 15. And that was a very impressionable time. And it was fascinating because it gave me something to that I could understand that was mystical, that I didn't really understand, but I knew something about it was true. And so that satisfied a big part of my seeking urge. And from that point forward, it's just been an interest that I've always had to seek more of the mystery of this universe that we live in and how we are all connected. And I think that's really important as humans, because isolation is a big problem. You know, we isolate ourselves in our homes, we isolate ourselves in community, and a lot of people are feeling really alone and lacking the sense of love and connection. And so I think that that is the roadmap to realize that we really are connected. When we can feel it in our own bodies and have that visceral experience of connection with source, it changes things.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that Laguna as a community is more open to that sort of connection?
Yeah, and I think that's why I landed here. I've been here for 20 years, on and off. And I always loved the community of Laguna, the beauty of Laguna. I think that it was founded, you know, Native Americans and artists were the founders of this land. And I think that energy still remains today. It's changed a lot over the time. But I can say that for us, we have experienced a really rich and beautiful community. And you may know that we are one of the we were on the news, in the newspaper for I think a year around the issue of our sweat lodge and our teepee in our backyard. So we got a lot of press about our spirituality, and it was a long, grueling experience. But at the end of the day, it's been really beautiful. We've been embraced, and we have community events where we can come and sit and pray together as community, and it's really beautiful. Share ceremony and sit on the earth, mm-hmm. feel the heartbeat of the mother. That's right. Really important.
What about that do you think people were struggling with?
I think it's fear of, you know, something different, change, unknown, the unknown, fear of the unknown. Mm-hmm. I think that the perception might have been that we were some, you know, drug-taking hippies that were going to all be naked in a sweat lodge, which
okay,
isn't the
might
case.
Be something else, but yeah.
Which wasn't the case at all. It's a very reverent ceremony right. that's thousands of years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you began that with your husband, mm-hmm. right? And yes. how did that, can you talk a little bit about how that began, or did you meet yeah. in some environment that fostered this connection?
We did. We met, I think it's been 5 years now that we've been together. We met through ceremony, mm-hmm. and I've been running spiritual retreats in Ojai for about 10 years, and he would run the ceremony for my retreats. So we would see each other once a year for a few years, and just for the ceremony day, and it was very, like I said, very reverent experience, very devotional, and then wouldn't see each other for another year. And while we were always very close, we never saw each other in that way. And then there was a day where we were on retreat together, and neither one of us was in relationship, and it was as though spirit lifted a veil, and suddenly we saw each other and said, nice to see you again.
And that was the beginning?
That was the beginning,
wow,
yeah.
Wow.
And
amazing.
It was a very rapid movement, yeah.
Okay.
He was living in Ojai at the time, and he moved down to Laguna shortly thereafter.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's amazing.
Yeah, it's been great.
That's great. When you say ceremony, for those of us who don't really know a lot about that, mm-hmm. can you kind of just describe, is it a day? You know, what does that really mean? And what's that experience like?
That's a good question. I mean, in the context of ceremony, I'm sure everyone would have their own relationship with that. Essentially, for us, the ceremony that we're working with is a ceremony honoring the earth, honoring spirits, our ancestors, honoring all things. And it's a Native American ceremony. Andrew runs a traditional Lakota lodge.
Okay.
And again, it's ancient. It's been around for thousands of years. And what's beautiful is that he does run it in the traditional way. A ceremony day would look like pretty much a full day from 1 o'clock to 6 o'clock. We have a beautiful time sitting in the lodge and sharing our hearts and sharing our prayers for the earth and for all things. And then we share food afterwards in celebration.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And how many people participate in something like this?
It can be anywhere from 5 to 25.
Okay.
Depending on the interest.
And how do they plan those days? Is there a connection? Is there like a, how does that community communicate with one another?
We generally send out email communications. We've got a website that people can go on if they want to sign up for newsletters and find out what's going on, mm-hmm. whether it be retreats off-site or the ceremonies on-site.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I know you were also in the corporate world.
Yes.
So how does this world lie up against that world, and what's that been like for you?
I'm still in the corporate world, and it has been a question on my heart for a long time. I think that everything that we do prepares us for who we are, for the discovery of who we are. Mm-hmm. It takes a lifetime to really discover who we are. And I turned 50 this year, so I think I'm about halfway through. The corporate world, I learned a lot about structure and organization, and my creativity was great in terms of my entrepreneurial spirit of putting things together. And a concept, bringing a concept into form, is really the alchemy that occurs in a corporate world. And I like to play with energy. One of my businesses is called Alchemy of the Heart. This is the one we've been speaking of. And I like that word alchemy because it's taking energy and putting it into form. Whatever we're doing, if our heart is involved in that process, it creates form. And that's an exciting process for me. So I started to see that first of all, there was a bridge in what I was seeing in the corporate world with so much dissatisfaction. And that led me on a quest, my own personal quest of being tense and in a lot of pain in my body, wondering, what is this? What am I going to do with this? And then discovering through the meditation process that there was some relief, and that what I was struggling for was getting off of that wheel of doing and moving more into a context of being. And so I'm still in the corporate world, but I've been blessed to feel this bridge where I can work with both worlds.
So what do you think corporations could be doing to sort of improve this process of being, and therefore productivity and well-being for employees? What are your thoughts about that?
I think that fortunately, there are a lot of corporations that are moving in this direction, but wellness initiatives, which is fairly new on the scene over the last few years, are starting to embrace meditation as part of one of their offerings. You know, a lot of corporations have gyms for people to work out and now are offering alternative therapies and like meditation for wellness. I think wellness is key, and our whole model of grinding it away until you have nothing left doesn't work. And people are moving massively out into the retirement field, and then we're finding that there isn't a skill set in the corporate world that there once was, or maybe a work ethic that there once was. So it's really important to take care of our people, no matter where we are, and to offer things, offer opportunities for sustainability, whether that be in our personal life, our corporate world, our communities. Sustainability is really the theme I think that we should all be looking at in every way.
Yeah, I definitely agree. We're going to take a quick break from our visit with Carrie Woodburn. And here's a song from the movie Big Eyes by Lana Del Rey.
You watched me from, I said goodbye. suspended in the sun. I had a dream that I was fine. I wasn't crazy.
And that was Lana Del Rey's song, Big Eyes, from the movie Big Eyes, and the song I Can Fly. I'd like to remind our listeners that you are listening to Loved with Kim Sage on KX at One Laguna. Loved is a live weekly talk show about love and relationships and sometimes about movies. I work as a therapist in Newport Beach, and today we are talking with Carrie Woodburn about relationships and the relationships between self, love, the soul, and art. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thanks, Kim.
So we were talking a lot about art and creativity and the soul before. One of the other topics I've seen you talk about is this concept of masculine and feminine energy and the balance between the two. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to start with a line from that last song that you played. I think it said, "I wasn't crazy, I was divine." Mm. That really struck me. And it's a segue, I think, into this topic because I believe from my own experience, what I discovered in life is that one of the greatest struggles that we experience, and I can only speak as women because I am a woman, but I think it's universal, is that we struggle with this concept that we are supposed to be a certain way in the world, which is actually a very masculine way of doing and always just doing it all, handling it all, taking care of so many people, all of our loved ones. And usually we're the last ones that we care for is ourself. And I figured that my earlier years of adult years were probably 99.9% in my masculine energy because I really didn't have a concept of what is feminine energy. I mean, I know it's beautiful, I know it's graceful, I know all those things, and, you know, I would consider that I embodied some of those things, but I didn't feel the feminine energy that I didn't know I was missing it until I discovered it, and what I discovered it was through this process of painting. My creativity was a devotional dance, I guess you could say, with the Mother Earth. And what I realized through my process of painting is that I was being shown through the essence of what I was feeling, what was moving through me as energy, the feminine spirit. And what that, it's very difficult to articulate, but I suppose I would say what it felt like was the mother, just incredibly nurturing, loving, all-encompassing, nothing that looked like what I thought was feminine, which was self-abandonment and self-sacrifice. It was the complete opposite. So that led me on a quest to explore more about what is it to be balanced. Because I think what's really critical in terms of what I call being in right relation with self and all things is being in harmonization, being harmonized in those feminine and masculine principles, which we all share equally, whether we're incarnate as a man or a woman. And that harmonization allows for expansion and creativity to move through in a really beautiful way. I don't know that I have a lot of words to articulate it. Mostly the way that I work with that energy is through the creative process. And what comes from that is a desire. When one opens to this in whatever form, whether it's working with me or working with whoever, working with yourself, you know, there's a lot of ways to access the truth of things. The best advice I can give is to feel deeply into, especially for women, that nurturing aspect and to invite ourselves to explore the inquiry, how well am I loving myself? How well am I taking care of myself? Do I put myself at the end of the list or do I put myself at the top of the list? That was a simple context for me when I realized how deficient I was and how thirsty I was for nourishment. It changed everything for me. And so, you know, it's not at all harsh. It's really quite beautiful because when we're full, when our vessel is really, truly full, there is so much abundance and grace for everyone, for all of those that we care about and that we share life with. But when our vessel is empty, what usually ends up happening is there's resentment, there's anger, there's frustration, there's physical pain, there's emotional trauma, there's a lot of dissatisfaction. So I don't know if that answers your question directly, but yeah. That is, in general, what led me to that exploration was knowing that I was in a deeply masculine way of being. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered the more feminine way of being, it brought some balance to my life.
So how did those changes affect your family? Because obviously when you shift like that, it shifts in your family, the dynamics.
It was significant. For me, I ended a marriage of 20 years. And this is a man that I care deeply for still. However, the relationship wasn't such that I could expand into different agreement, I guess. I didn't feel that anyway. Mm-hmm. So it changed my family dynamic quite a bit. And I'm not saying that's going to be so for everyone, but for me, that's just what it was. And my children, as a result, I believe there was some trauma, of course, but I believe that the demonstration of being that I represent really gives them permission to fully be who they are. And that's more important than anything we say, is how we be.
Absolutely.
And what we do.
So can you give me a concrete example of what you do differently now that you didn't do before?
I say no a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. Instead of, yeah, sure, I can do that. Yeah, sure, I can do that.
Yeah, definitely.
I have boundaries. I didn't have boundaries before. That was probably the biggest action.
Yeah, I think boundaries are probably the greatest part of my work with people is, mm-hmm. you know, this is me, this is you, here's where I draw the line. And I think people need to know their own limits. And oftentimes we don't even know our own limits.
Yeah.
So that makes it challenging. How do you think this energy balance plays out within romantic relationships?
I do believe that the more balanced we are, the more aware, let me say not balanced, the more aware we are of ourselves and our own exchange of energy, the greater our capacity to magnetize a relationship that's going to fit that. So what I've learned about relationship is when I'm not in a context of self-love with myself, I'm not necessarily likely to be in a relationship of a loving relationship. That's what I've discovered is through being fiercely self-loving and taking care of myself and what do I need? That's a question I ask myself a lot. What do I need? That has allowed me to magnetize a relationship of love that I never knew existed. I really didn't know what love was. I thought I knew, but again, I thought it was all these things of this is who you have to be to serve. And I was really confused around love. Now I understand that love is a context that expands both people. So when two people are honoring themselves first and foremost, and I think that's what comes out of the harmonization of masculine and feminine principles is self-honor. It's a lack of self-abandonment and it's an act of self-honor mm-hmm. and delighting in who we are. And so when one is in a space of self-honor and delight, that's really attractive and really magnetic. But it will only magnetize someone who has those same principles as a priority. It won't magnetize someone who feels that perhaps, you know, you should be less so they could be more, or I should be less so you could be more.
Right.
Right? So I think that's the magic.
Yeah, because that was my question. I'm thinking, okay, so some types of men and women are not going to feel magnetized by these role changes because they really are role shifts.
Yes.
And if you have it pretty firmly in your head that things have to look a certain way, and then they don't, you often end up alone, you know,
right.
thinking that that's the way it works. So as a mother of boys and girls, how has this affected in terms of, you think, the way they see themselves and their masculine and feminine energy in the world?
I believe that our children have been given permission to experience the fullness of who they are so that the boys have permission to feel and to talk about their feelings. Even if they don't want to sometimes.
Which is sometimes the challenging
yeah.
part.
With a mother like me, they're probably encouraged a little bit more than they'd like.
Yes, I get that. Can you not be a therapist at home, please?
Yeah, of course, right. I get that mom a lot.
Yeah. How do you feel about that? My kids will even mock me. Mom, how do you feel about that?
Yes. Like, that's juicy terrain.
I'm like, you don't really want to know, maybe. So your kids get to witness that and be a part of that.
They do. And one of the practices that we have as a home is our family dinners. We mm-hmm. sit around the table and every family dinner, we have an opportunity for sharing something on our heart. And it may just be a topic of whatever's in the news. How do you feel about that? Or what was the worst part of your day? Or what was the best part of your day? Something simple like that. So they know when we gather as a family, it's like circle time.
Right.
Everyone has an opportunity to have a voice and to feel their own heart in relation to the other, mm-hmm. male and female.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful thing. I think that practice, that simple practice, has bonded our family in ways that I just couldn't even dream of.
I believe it. I think it's so important.
Mm.
So given that, what advice would you give to the parent who says, well, I've tried to get my child to talk and they say, I've got nothing or, you know, I don't know. How do you respond to that?
My advice and response would be, how rigorous are you with your own sharing? Because they learn by how we be. They learn by the example that we offer. They really don't, especially after 5 years old, they really don't respond as much to what we say versus what we do and how we be.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you can't make another human being respond in any way. But what you can do is you can demonstrate a way to be that is really fulfilling and expansive and vibrant. Mm-hmm. That's the key. Vibrancy. How vibrant are we living? That's the question I would ask everyone.
Yeah, that's a great question. I like that a lot. I noticed in your paintings, you do paint women. Mm-hmm. So was that really truly the image that first emerged? I mean, can you talk a little bit about that for you?
Yeah, the first piece that emerged for me is called Shakti Woman Emerging. And she was a goddess that emerged out of the earth in the form of a tree. And she's the inner portion of that tree. And what's flowing through here is the energy of serpent, which is like the kundalini energy, the sensual movement of woman. Her womb is like an egg. It's holding the mystery of creation in the fullness of that pre-birth. And she's holding her arms out, and there's flowers, magnolia flowers, dripping from the top of her. And that's the fragrance of woman. And that was the first piece that I completed. And each one of them feels like it's a teaching, like the Earth Mother is showing me something of my own nature and our nature as not only women, but men in general, both, because mm-hmm. it's the balance, again, that harmonization of masculine and feminine, to have the rootedness of the tree and the fluidity of the center. That's a masculine and a feminine example. So she emerged as the first piece, and she showed me that it's safe to feel that inner landscape that at the time I was really dancing around in a lot of fear, and not only feel it, but open my arms and allow the fragrance of that discovery to be shared with others.
Wow, that's really beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an amazing idea, this whole part of our unconscious mind that comes out. And this is why I love to talk about films and art and all of that. So this topic has been just a fabulous topic to me, and I hope to our listeners. I do want to ask you a few more questions, but before I get to that, at the beginning of the show, we were talking about the film Big Eyes, and you mentioned that your paintings had the eyes closed, and you just recently painted their eyes opened.
Yeah.
To what do you... owe that change? Where do you think that's coming from for you?
I believe that I didn't think about this at the time until the first one revealed with her eyes open. I believe that the eyes closed was a metaphor for the deep internal work that I've been doing personally on the inner landscape and looking at every aspect of the shadow and everything within me, all the places that I want to hide from. And it required those eyes closed to go deep into that space. And the eyes open feels like a celebration and that I'm ready to see with new eyes and be seen through new eyes.
Beautiful. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Well, before we head into our final segment today, I'd like to remind our audience that you're listening to Love with Kim Sage on KX at One Laguna. And at the end of each interview, I have some questions for my guests. So, Carrie, you're really the first one to dive on board with these. And they are much in the sort of thinking of the Actor's Studio with James Lipton kind of questions, which I modified, given that this is a relationship and love show and not technically a show with movie stars. So, although you're a star, I'm glad you're here. So you can just give, you know, easy answers, whatever works for you. So the first question is, what word makes you smile?
Delight.
What word makes you cringe?
Oh, violence.
Where is your happy place?
My happy place is in my garden and my teepee.
Sounds beautiful. What sound or noise do you love?
I love the sound of my children's laughter.
That was mine too, with each other. Yeah, definitely. So what sound or noise do you hate?
I don't like the sound of chaos.
That's not a good one.
Mm-mm.
What is the best thing about being in a relationship with you?
Oh, you never know who you're going to wake up with.
That's never boring, right?
Yes.
That's always a good thing for women to be, never boring. If you only have an hour to yourself to do as you wish, what is your favorite thing to do?
Usually my favorite thing to do is some sort of creativity, either stitch some leather or paint a little bit.
And what is your go-to emotion?
My most comfortable emotion is one of satisfaction.